Coming up in This Week in Computer Hardware, Vega is not here yet, but we got prices and ship dates. Broadpone means you need to patch iOS and Android. Dell U3818TDW and Acer's VR headset costs a mere $300. All that and more coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 426, recorded August 3rd, 2017. Update your phone now.
This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by iFixit, the free online repair manual for everything. Before you start your next build or fix, head over to ifixit.com/twit to snag the fully loaded Pro Tech Toolkit for only $59.95. And check out their array of high-quality parts, tools, and guides.
Welcome to Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, Twitch weekly show that brings you the most useful, most engaging, most informative, and occasionally most amusing news in desktop, mobile, and, well, PC hardware. We love it if it's running Android, iOS, Windows, Linux. Just bring us the hardware and tell us to talk, and we're here for you. I'm Patrick Norton, joined as always by Mr. Ryan Schrouts.
Hello, hello. And, we will definitely talk. We have no issues with that.
Talk will happen. So you and Alan last week, you got deep on the Ryzen 3, which seems to be the processor of choice, under $150. For under $100, the Pentium G4560 definitely seems to be the one to watch. Yep. Or the one to beat. And, you know, we were talking about it on Tech Thing this week. I suddenly have an urge to build another, console challenging $400-ish gaming PC. As I do every so often. But AMD has not stopped bringing the news. They finally came up with a launch date for the Radeon RX Vega 64 and Vega 56. We got specs. We got prices. We know exactly how much power they're going to consume, which is a staggering amount by contemporary graphics card values. What we don't have, though, is benchmarks. It seems like AMD's being really solid on making sure the benchmarks don't hit until after the pre-orders or with the pre-orders.
Perhaps. I don't actually know what the pre-orders are yet for Ryzen, or for Vega at least. Yeah, right. It's odd, right? So they've detailed the specs and the clocks and the pricing and these weird bundle deals and stuff, but they're very particular about the performance data that they showed. So I last weekend I was in LA and I was talking to AMD directly about it, and they kind of nudged their way through pricing by talking about the idea of 99th percentile minimum frame rates and how this applies to variable refresh rate displays and stuff like that, right? So the general idea is, if you have a variable refresh rate display, a FreeSync display in this case, that has a 3440 by 1440 resolution enthusiast, high-end enthusiast monitor, and it has a variable refresh rate of 48 to 100. If you are inside that range, your gaming performance should be quite good. If you're below that, it has the possibility of tearing or stuttering, and it's a worse experience. So they basically were comparing the RX Vega 64 to the GTX 1080 purely on what is the kind of bottom 1% frame rate of both of these platforms. And obviously the winner in the games they selected and the settings they selected was the Vega 64.
Shocking.
You know, yes, weird, right? And there is some... there's some validity to that argument that as long as you are within the right, FPS range for your setup, whatever it happens to be, that any performance you get above that may be less useful than anything else, right? So if you're on a 60 hertz monitor and you play games with VSync on, then every frame rate improvement you see over 60 is kind of useless, right? Unless you enable fast sync or enhanced sync or these other technologies, and you start to get into a whole bunch of difficulties. But that's the reason we use average frame rates, why we look for frame variances and deviations of frame times, is not because, we as reviewers and analysts and all that goodness and enthusiasts that follow all this stuff don't understand that that sometimes going above a certain amount is useless. It's that we can't predict everybody's setup, right? So right now, 34 by 40, you can get 144 hertz screens. So now all of a sudden, now the question becomes, you know, okay, on a G-Sync monitor, you can go up to 144 hertz and still be in variable refresh. So now every frame rate, the average frame rate and how high it can go is going to matter more than it did in AMD's kind of created 48 to 100 hertz scenario. So, you know, we don't have the cards yet. We'll have the cards soon. You've seen our Frontier Edition testing. I guess it's worth talking a little bit on the specs and how they actually change from the Frontier Edition, because they are different. There's an air-cooled variant and a water-cooled variant. The clock speeds are higher on the RX cards than the Frontier Edition cards by a little bit. What's interesting is actually if you look at that table, the boost clock of the RX Vega Air is listed at 1546. But the boost clock of the Vega Frontier Edition Air was listed at 1600. So in theory, you would think actually the RX Vega 64 Air is slower. But they're actually changing the way they're reporting clock speeds with this release as well. The RX Vega marks the first time AMD will begin to report average typical clock speeds as boost clocks. So the clock speed you should actually see your GPU run at while gaming is 1546. Whereas previously, even as recently as the Vega Frontier Edition, that 1600 megahertz mark was the peak clock that it might hit in a perfect environment.
For several seconds.
Right, exactly. Yes, correct.
Before actually doing much of the game.
So the clock speeds should be more indicative of real-world performance with RX Vega than they were in Frontier Edition. And that's good. Because if you look at like the liquid-cooled card, 1677 boost clock, that's actually higher than I think our overclocked liquid cooled Vega Frontier Edition testing looked. So, you know, there's a chance that we see some noticeable performance improvements with these cards, you know, on the order of 7 to 12% over what we tested on Frontier Edition. You know, they do have half the memory, 8 gigs instead of 16. It's running at the same speed, mm-hmm. same TDP concerns, you know, basically 350 watts for the liquid cooled and 300 watts for the air cooled. And then that new guy, the Vega 56, which, by the way, the Vega 64 doesn't stand for 64-bit, doesn't stand for 64 clock deviations. It stands for 64 compute units, which have 64 stream processors in them. So you can kind of do the math and figure out how they get the, you know, how we get to 4096 GPU cores. It's a little odd for them to suddenly use a specification in the title. I just think it also kind of sounded neat, Vega 64, Vega 56. But the 56 is an interesting part because its TDP is much more reasonable, 210 watts. The clock speeds are lower, but it's going to be $399. So it's competing against the GTX 1070. And apparently it's, according to what AMD has told me, it's going to win against the 1070. All they'll say about the Vega 64 is that it will be competitive with the 1080, whereas they claim the Vega 56 will win and beat the 1070, and it should have a potential substantial amount of overclocking headroom. But, I mean, it's, you know, they look good. The cards, you know, the kind of the standard model of the Vega 64 and 56 just looks like the Radeon reference design we've seen for a very long time now, which is unfortunate. They have two of the liquid cooled that has the shiny silver shroud with the red Radeon logo in the corner, which I really like. And then right. they have the limited edition air cooled, but it's going to be $100 more. And, you know, I think it's they only plan on having it available through September or something like that. So it's going to be a little bit harder to get a hold of. But then the partner cards from Asus and whatnot will be out sometime in September as well.
They're beautiful cards. I mean, I love the design all the way across. I'm curious.
I do. I really do.
I'm very curious to see what the delta in gaming performance is between the, you know, the Frontier Edition and the RX Vega 64. And as someone who just bought a 1070, I'm really curious to see what the RX Vega 56 performance looks like and, you know, if they beat it, by how much they beat it at. You know, do you think NVIDIA is going to turn around and have a GTX 1090 sitting in the wings ready to go to sort of one up AMD, or do you expect them to just kind of wait patiently to see whether or not AMD can deliver enough volume to even keep their prices
in line during the launch of the product. And because that's something we've seen so often, even when we're not having Bitcoin bumps, where there's a new GPU launched and they sell all six of them, and then everybody's either selling them for a significant, you know, vig over the MSRP, or you just simply can't get them for several weeks. I mean, too early to tell at this point.
Well, so I would say in the last week or so, we've seen the coin mining stuff kind of level off a little bit and actually regress some, which is good. In other words, based on our testing, the value of the performance of a 1080 Ti for coin mining through something like NiceHash has gone from about $10 per day to about $250 per day. Which is, you know, bad for people who invested in mining, but great for people who actually want to buy video cards for graphics. As we looked around yesterday, you could actually find 1080 Ti's and 1080s, you know, within $10, $20 of MSRPs, which is way better than what we've seen in the past. So hopefully that keeps up. I will say that I don't expect NVIDIA to make any response to this release immediately, or really maybe even through the end of the year, right? So if the 1080 is competitive in price, you know, they'll lean on some other features and capabilities. They may do some driver tweaks. They may work with some partners to do $20 and $30 rebates, so the prices go down a little bit more. But they still have the 1080 Ti. Like the Vega 64 is not going to beat that. So they still will have the crown of the enthusiast gaming graphics card. But on the mining thing again, I will say that, like, talking with AMD's product managers and kind of the executives trying to figure out how they were going to do this launch, it was really hard to come up with a plan to launch a new product when a month ago cards were selling for double what they were supposed to be selling for. And you have to come out and determine what the pricing scheme for your product is going to be. And as a company, you don't want to sell it for too little, thinking that, you know, knowing that you could have made, you know, $100 extra per card in that interim time frame. But then you also have to be careful about how you market it, so that, like, because reviewers, when we look at this card, we will look at it as, you know, MSRPs are this. Yes, the ecosystem is set up this way, but we believe it will return to, you know, state X.
Right.
And so it's an interesting thing for them. And that's kind of where those Radeon packs come into play. I don't know if you saw what even that stuff was about. If you pay $100 more for your graphics card, which is essentially what it is, if you pay $599 for the Vega 64 air cooled instead of $499, or $499 instead of $399 for the Vega 56, you get access to these Radeon packs, which allow you to optionally get $200 off of a Radeon FreeSync enabled monitor, $100 off of a Ryzen 7 CPU and motherboard combo, and two included games, Wolfenstein 2 and Prey. So if you want to buy that hardware, it's a pretty good deal, right? You're paying $100 more for a card to get $300 in discounts towards other hardware and two free games. Now, if you don't want this hardware, or you don't want these games, you're essentially being asked to pay $100 more for just the card, which you can do. That's the only way to get the limited edition. It's the only way to get the liquid cooled card for the foreseeable future. And the worry is, you know, so these cards will exist in two different states at Newegg. You'll have the $499 option of the Vega 64 and the $599 option of the Vega 64. And the allocation of those two things will be very interesting. If we come to a point where you cannot buy the card for $499, but there's plenty available for sale for $599 with this optional bundle, then that tells us that, you know, AMD is just, they want to get $100 more out of each card, but they didn't want the stigma of being priced at $599 to kind of follow them around. So they're kind of doing this workaround way of doing it. If both versions are available for, you know, equal amounts of time, then okay, they're balancing out. I think it was a pretty good hedge play on AMD's part, because it allowed them to sell a card at $599. If they were selling at $599 continually, there's no reason for them to back it off to $499. But this gives them the ability to move cards back and forth between those two price points based on the position of you know, what the sales happen to look like, without having to eat crow of suddenly launching at $599 and having an immediate price drop to $499, which would be, you know, pretty damaging, I think, from an external standpoint. So we'll have to see. These go on sale on August 14th. Our reviews will be live on August 14th. And we'll be able to tell you what we recommend. August is going to be just as interesting and exciting as the rest of the whole damn year has been, apparently. So,
you know, there are, for somebody who runs a website dedicated to hardware, I think there are worse things than exciting hardware releases.
Correct.
You know,
I agree.
They could be a little more streamlined. one of the other articles came out this week, you know, Wolfenstein 2 optimized for AMD Vega with FP16 shader support. This is coming out from golem.de if you want to get your German on. Ironically, there are multiple German speakers in the building right now, so if anybody wants me to have that translated by non-technical Germans, I'm happy to have that done. But it's interesting. So FP16 shader support from a new version of the id Tech 6 engine. And, of course, the game supports, you know, DX12 and the Vulkan API. You know, so in theory, using half-precision calculations could offer higher frame rates for AMD Vega users. We'll see. Because, of course,
yeah,
the cards aren't out yet.
Right. It's interesting because from an architectural standpoint, the Vega GPU doesn't really have a whole lot of changes from Polaris or even Fiji, right, in terms of the IPC right. of the GPU. What the new features they've added are this FP16 slash half precision slash double packed math, depending on what who you're asking what they're going to call it. And then things like the ideas of new primitive shaders, new geometry pipelines, all of these things, the HBCC, the cache controller, all of these things require external forces to come into play, right? So the developer has to integrate support for FP16. The developer has to integrate support for primitive shaders, right? APIs should probably build in support for primitive shaders. And then once those things happen, you start to see some benefits on Vega that you didn't see on Polaris or Fiji in terms of actual like gaming throughput. But I think, and if you look at some of the numbers that came around with Vega Frontier Edition, if you look at clock for clock, Vega is performing almost identically to Fiji, the Fury X card. So until, you know, the AMD is going to be very much rah-rahing these types of games that will even implement FP16, even if it might, you know, you might see a 20% improvement in a specific shader performance. But that, you know, several of those combined, depending on how much of the load of the game they are, might end up being, you know, a couple of percent, maybe up to 10% difference. But that's a long-term goal, not a short-term goal for Vega.
We wait with bated breath again. And, of course, Asus announced four RX Vega 64 GPUs, headlined by ROG Strix RX Vega 64 Overclocked Edition. So, the Strix RX Vega 64 Overclock Edition, the RX Vega 64, the Vega 64 Water-Cooled Edition, and the RX Vega 64 Air-Cooled Edition, Black and Silver Editions. So many options. I mean, do we expect any kind of massive performance delta between the cards, you know, directly from AMD versus the cards coming through Asus?
So there might be some interesting differences, right? Because if they're not listing the base and boost clocks on their cards yet, Asus. But I know from talking to some of them that the goal is to get their custom air-cooled cards to the same performance level of the liquid-cooled card, right? So and I think that's something they'll be able to do because of the giant heat sinks and triple fan designs that they put on these non-blower coolers that Asus integrates and Sapphire has and, you know, MSI has and all this type of stuff are more effective. But they're not good in some instances, like if you have a really small form factor case or you're integrating a bunch of things into a system design. And that's why these reference designs are always blower style coolers. So I do think we'll see some differences. You'll probably pay, you know, instead of $499, you'll pay $529 or $549 for that Asus Strix card, and it'll run probably up near the reference liquid cooled product in clock speeds. So that's just a guess at this point, but I do think the Vega architecture, because of its sensitivity to thermals and power consumption, will benefit more from better cooling than we have seen in previous GPU generations, right? NVIDIA, right, very power efficient, more voltage limited rather than thermally limited. So it's not, hasn't really been an issue. They kind of limit the voltage peaks that you can get into. So with this, I do think you'll see some advantages. I mean, if you look back at our Frontier Edition testing, where we simply, you know, spun up the fan speed a whole bunch on the original Frontier Edition air-cooled card, and you see, you know, not significant but noticeable clock speed changes, you know, that's the kind of advantages you get by going with one of these custom designs. Very different look and style, so it depends on what you're into. Mm-hmm. But I do think we'll see notably better perf on some of these.
And, of course, Asus's applications for overclocking, which are generally a nice touch.
Yep.
The one last thing in our Festival of AMD, Threadripper 1900X got dropped at SIGGRAPH in Los Angeles this week. That one's going to be coming out $549, 8 cores, 16 threads, 3.8 gigahertz base clock, which is a bit higher than the 3.4 and 3.5 gigahertz on the 1950X and 1920X. They all hit the same claimed turbo boost of 4 gigahertz. 64 PCIe lanes, essentially the same performance numbers outside of the number of cores you're looking at for the 1950X, 1920X. So there is, pre-order date, on sale date for Threadripper, should you be looking at the super high end of multiple core computing. And the 1950 is currently, selling for $1,000 on Amazon.com in pre-order. That'll be released on August 10th, 2017. The 1920X selling for $799, also on August 10th, 2017. And X399 motherboards are still bouncing all over the place. Shop carefully, because a lot of times I've noticed, especially on Amazon, less so on Newegg, that when you are searching for a particular chipset on the motherboard, they are often sliding in motherboards that have almost no relationship whatsoever to either the manufacturer you're looking for or the chipset you're looking for. So just because you searched for an X399 motherboard, don't assume actually is an X399 motherboard. I just want to say that, because I don't want anybody out there to drop $300 or $270 for a motherboard and have their chip arrive, you know, late at that 8 p.m. same day delivery on August 10th, or, you know, the next day delivery on August 11th, and be like, damn you, Amazon.
That's true. Good point.
You know, I would also not entirely be surprised if you had to, you know, in my case, ended up having to order a second motherboard because my bundle from Amazon that Amazon made me order to get the processor and the CPU delivered, because they wouldn't let me, I couldn't get the CPU delivered separately. They didn't have any of those SKUs available. The motherboard that I ordered bundled with my CPU arrived 3 weeks, almost a month after the processor did. So I ended up owning, I owned several AMD Ryzen compatible motherboards. always another option for a build project there, but something to be aware of when you're shopping, because it's been a little surprising.
Yeah. The 1900X was a surprise. I think we had talked about on this show if maybe AMD would release a 10-core part,
right,
to kind of bridge the gap between Ryzen 7 and Threadripper. They went with the 8-core, which is, in most ways the performance will be very similar between those two parts, except that the base clock on the 1900X is 200 megahertz higher than the base clock of the 1800X. So your worst case performance, your fully loaded, highly threaded performance, is actually going to be, 200 megahertz faster than it was on the previous platform.
Right.
But you get the extra PCIe lanes, you get quad channel memory, you get access to a totally different platform of motherboards, which they are more expensive than X370 boards. It's a very similar situation between the X299 and the X270, or the Z270 on the Intel side, right? You're paying more, a little bit more for the processor, but you get better, you get different board options, I will say.
Right.
And this is clearly an attack of, if you go back to the table, the Core i7-7820X, which is the 8-core, 16-thread Intel Skylake X part, which is $599. So, but it only has 28 lanes of PCIe, and you know the clock speeds are pretty high on it. So it'll be interesting to see how those parts, the 7820, compares to the 7900X when we get that in as well.
It should be exciting. And the 1900 is currently not up for pre-order on Amazon, in case you're looking for it. And the 1800X is now selling for $419 on Amazon, down from its launch price of $499.
That's just pretty significant. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes, it is. You know what else is significant? Being able to fix your stuff. This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware brought to you by iFixit. We've both been fans of iFixit for a long time. Of course, they're a sponsor here at This Week in Computer Hardware. But, they love to take stuff apart and teach you how to take things apart so you can fix them or make an informed decision about whether or not you should buy something in the first place. Oh, yeah, you can replace the drive in that Surface Pro. Well, yeah, but it's going to be emotionally traumatizing to do it. And you can see just how emotionally traumatizing or easy it is if you go to the manuals. Repair videos up at iFixit. Galaxy S8, iPhones, the Switch. They're leading the charge in the electronics repair tools industry with their iconic black and blue ProTech toolkit. I have one at my home, in my toolkit at my home. I have one at the office. My wife has one, so she doesn't steal mine. I bought one for my kids. I love these things. They use them to take stuff apart. I use them to fix things. Sometimes I use them to fix things the kids taken apart. If you check out the ProTech toolkit in the iFixit store, they explain how each piece of the kit was meticulously designed. You're not going to find a higher quality toolkit like this on the market. And don't let the sleek design fool you. The toolkit's got both beauty and brawn, high quality steel bits, tools tough enough to handle any repair or mod you throw at them. I did a 1,500-mile road trip recently with a ProTech toolkit in the toolbox with my giant, heavy-duty, industrial-grade tools that travel with my truck. Nothing got damaged. I've fixed bicycles with these, glasses, toilets, laptops, computer screens, headphones. There's a crazy list of stuff I've used the ProTech toolkit with, and I haven't damaged a bit yet. And that says something about the quality of the bits inside that kit. What's really amazing is it's only $59.95. It comes in a tool roll that makes it compact and easy to store. That 64-bit driver kit has pretty much anything you might need for DIY electronics repair. And it makes it really, really easy to keep your bits organized. If you've ever opened up a drawer and been searching through like, oh, I need a Pentalo bit for a phone, you don't want to be sitting there with a magnifying glass trying to figure out which one of the Pentalo bits is. The bits are labeled. Their storage spots are labeled. You know, the bit kit's held down by a magnetic mat so you can use it to hold your screws and stuff when you're pulling electronics apart. There's a really nice swivel top magnetic precision driver inside of there. There's a flex extension if you have, like, let's say, the inside of a motherboard case where you have to bend the driver over to kind of get the bit to seat in a screw down there in the corner. Plastic opening tools, spudgers, picks, a suction cup with a really nice handle that makes it easy to remove display assemblies. The Jimmy pry tool, it's something iFixit basically invented to make it easier to get stuff open. A set of metal spudgers, electrostatic discharge safe tweezers, and an ESD safety strap so you don't destroy your job with static shock if you're in the part of the country where when you move, you generate electricity. And the best part, they're all backed by iFixit's lifetime warranty. You don't need to buy something to get iFixit's free repair resources. But, you know, if you want to, they'd appreciate it and would help support them to make these amazing repair guides available for free. There's over 25,000 free repair guides over at iFixit.com. If you've never been there, go there and look up something you might want to fix in your life, and you might be amazed at what you find there. Want to tackle your next hack, fix, or build with the ProTech Toolkit? Visit iFixit.com/twit to snag the fully loaded ProTech Toolkit for only $59.95. And we want to thank iFixit for their support of This Week in Computer Hardware and making it so easy to fix so many things in my life that have been broken. My children provide opportunities for me to continue to use my beloved ProTech Toolkit. And my wife does, and the neighbors do, and some of the people here in the office. Oh, my goodness. It sounds silly, but it's a lifestyle choice. And, you know, if I can save $700-800, I'm going to save it because I'm cheap that way. iFixit.com. It's good stuff, people. Or I should say iFixit.com/twit. It's good stuff, people. iPhone 8 can unlock your face in the dark. It's been really funny to watch the iPhone 8 rumors and where they've been coming as people get more and more frantic as we're moving closer and closer to September when we expect the iPhone 8 launch to come. This one is in Esquire, the sophisticated magazine for gentlemen that does not include too many pictures of scantily clad personages. But it's so funny because, it's... I'm just going to quote the article, which was put together by Sarah Rentz. When Apple released firmware for its new HomePod smart speaker last week, developer Steve Troughton-Smith found evidence that Apple will use infrared technology to make facial recognition an unlocking mechanism. So basically, you could like unlock your iPhone in the dark, or even if it's not particularly well located in front of your face, probably working with Touch ID, possibly as a replacement. There's a new bezel-less form factor, it looks like. The other thing that came out was a great Wired article this week where they talked about how the iPhone 8 is probably going to they basically said, it's going to be an elitist phone. You're not going to be able to afford it. Most people won't be able to afford it. But this is a good thing because if Apple is pushing if Apple is pushing for all of these sophisticated advanced features at the high end, the Samsung OLED screen, all sorts of other stuff, then those are, of course, eventually going to be democratized and come down to the less expensive models. But they're expecting this phone to price out at $1,200. And we're close enough to the launch date. Yes. I mean, yeah. I didn't expect such a visceral reaction from you. I think it's going to be very curious to see how expensive this phone is and what it ends up including. It's funny. The article on Wired is a super expensive phone is good news, even if you can't afford it. And it is as much as okay. Anything I've ever seen an ode to, I'm not going to say it's Apple fanboyish, but it's, it's an interesting,
I guess cameras. I understand the premise.
Yeah.
Right? Like the idea, we have $1,000 and $2,000 video cards and CPUs. And the idea is the hope that those features and core counts and options would come down into lower cost parts. And we have kind of seen that. It's been very slow because there's been no competition. Right. There's clearly competition in the smartphone market. So I do think that progression may happen more sustainably.
Well, yeah.
I love the idea of the face detection. I've seen some demos of... So it's not really just face detection. It's more of like depth sensing and this type of stuff. It's pretty interesting how the tech works. And if you don't have a button for Touch ID, you have to have something to continue to support that security and feature. And all the rumors had also been recently that the reason for the delay on the Apple iPhone 8 was not the face detect. It was about being able to get a Touch ID behind glass, right? Mm-hmm. Like, or behind like all the whole screen essentially, or something to that effect. Right. They haven't been able to perfect that technology. So that might be the bottleneck in which case you want to have both, right?
Right.
Face detect gets into a space where, if you can't do face detect, worst case, you can still do your password, but you can't use things like Apple Pay without a fingerprint, right? You can't use Apple Pay with just a password. That would be problematic, even if they allowed it. We kind of a pain waiting in line for somebody to remember their Apple ID password so they can buy their sandwich for lunch. But the tech is actually really cool. It will really help their implementations of AR. So the AR kit, sure. AR kit that they've been showing off, working on the current iPhones would in theory be significantly better, have the capability to be significantly better if you have super accurate depth sense technology that's even better than what you get on the what's the Google Tango devices that use a laser right. system that requires a very large lens, and it's not as quick in terms of its round trip latency time. So I'm excited to see what the tech is. I'm not excited about the idea of a $1,200 device. But you know, I probably have to try it. So
you're looking pain. I mean,
I am.
And look, we were talking a few weeks ago. I was testing an 8K desktop monitor that cost $5,000. They're talking about spending 60% more on the screen, on the OLED screen for the iPhone 8, right? The article says the estimate is that Apple spends $220 on parts for the iPhone 7. $43 of that, not quite a quarter, well, about an eighth of that goes towards the screen. And then, the big panel on the next iPhone, if it's an OLED, is probably going to cost 60% more than the existing screen inside of there. So, it's an interesting observation. And of course, what Apple would really like is to have the biggest freaking margins they can get, on their phones. And doing a very, very expensive, relatively low yield or, lower expensive phone with larger margins, they sell fewer of. It'll be curious, and I was talking with a couple of people recently. A friend of mine finally blew up his Droid. He was looking at a new phone and he had no interest in buying one flat out. He was perfectly willing to kind of bury the cost of the phone into 24 equal payments, which, what is it? Here's another quote. Anthony Scarsella, research manager at IDC. If $1,200 sounds scary, consider paying just $50 a month for the coolest phone ever. So we'll see what it ends up being. I'm curious, but we expect OLED screen, camera improvements, facial recognition, wireless charging, presumably a new processor. We'll see. We will see a little bit closer to the launch date. Acer's launching a VR headset, right? Their mixed reality headset is now up on the Microsoft Store. And Jeremy wrote this up after checking out an Inquirer article. It's $300. That's a big deal because the HoloLens that Microsoft sells is $300. $3,000, and let me make sure it's actually available at the Microsoft store.
Mine has shipped, apparently. I pre-ordered one of these, nice. I guess a long time ago, because I had no recollection of it. While I was in LA over the weekend, I looked down at my watch, and it told me that American Express was indicating that my credit card had just been charged $316, and I was like, whoa, what's going on? And I started this emergency investigation, because it didn't say, or it said Microsoft had charged it. And, do a search through my email for that specific amount and realize that I had pre-ordered this Acer mixed reality headset. I don't know what to expect from this, though, right? Like,
it's like buying the developer's version of the Oculus Rift back in the day. What you should expect, is probably somewhat more finished hardware, but with almost as little applications to actually run with it, because there's not much to do with it at this point, unless you're a dev and trying to write code for it.
I assume Windows has some kind of native capability with this, right? The Creators Update will probably have something in there so that I can navigate Windows. I believe and I do expect that this will be a better experience than that first Oculus dev kit, because Microsoft wouldn't release something in quite that state. And it does have pretty, steep. It still requires a GTX 1060 or an RX 480 graphics card. So they have some graphical capability challenges there, but it does have a low resolution. 800 by 600 is low, and resolution has been a pain point for the VR headsets we've seen so far. I just, I just, it was one of those things. We saw it launched, and I was like, well, clearly I'm going to want to cover this. So $299 it is, and we go forward and, you know, do what we're going to do. Hopefully it makes me infinitely more productive. That's all I can say.
I'm not holding my breath on that one.
Oh, well, that's probably a good idea. Yeah.
They're also completely sold out at the Microsoft store and all local stores, as near as I can tell. So, same thing for the HP Windows Mixed Reality Headset Developers Edition. So,
right. Yeah. Those launched at the same time at whatever Microsoft's development conference is. They talked about both of those. So that they should, I think, be identical, like, capability between the Acer and the HP. The Acer one is blue, though, and the HP one is black. So I don't know if that's why I did that, but I don't know.
That's almost as insightful about this as the statement that I'm going to make. The Dell UltraSharp 38 curved monitor, aka the U381 8DW, is almost exactly like my beloved Dell 34 curved ultra wide monitor, the U3415W, which I thought they were phasing out, but is still available up at Dell.com. And one of the things I like about the U34 versus, say, the U3017 is it has a very, very wide radius. I do not like the narrower radius. By the time you get up to a 34-inch monitor, a 1900-millimeter radius on the monitor is a little twisty for my taste. You get used to it, but initially I find it problematic. And even after a while, you'll still notice straight lines appear to be curved because the monitor kind of narrows down or curves so much. So that's one of the reasons I like the U3415. The curve radius on the U38 is very, very close to the 3415 because it's a 2300 radius rather than something much, 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 I guess, tighter in radius. But it's an interesting monitor.
The higher the number, the less curvature there is over the given distance. Okay.
Yeah, it's a little. I thought it was going to be a 3400R curve radius, but it looks like it is a much larger curve rate. Let me check that. It's funny they pulled the curve radius information off the 3415. I just wanted to double check that. But yeah, the larger the number, the shallower the curve, and the less you notice the curvature on the monitor.
Gotcha.
And I like having less curve in a curved monitor.
But, I'm in the same boat.
You know, other than that, it's essentially the same monitor, just 4 inches larger, which I got to say I'm enjoying in a lot of ways, although it is huge on my desktop. I actually had to move my speakers to the left and right to make enough room, like sort of poking their edges of the speakers off the edge of the table, because it is so impossibly wide. You know, a little bit higher resolution. The U3415 is 3440 by 1440, and then of that moment when the specs all change the order, 3840 by 1600 is on the 38-inch version of it. So, very, very similar layout. Both widescreen 21:9, but they basically gave you some extra pixels to make up for the additional real world real estate on the monitor. I love gaming on these monitors, and they're not nearly as challenging as a 4K monitor for your GPU. But something to keep an eye out there, and I'm going to use this for the next week, and I'll talk more about it. I'll talk more about it next week. Price is really good because they put the MSRP at $1,500, but they're selling it off Dell.com for $1,169, which usually means you'll be finding it at Dell's partner websites for a few hundred less. Not yet, though. So it's a little early for that to happen. But you're talking about something that competes with like LG's 38UC99 and some of the other high-end monitors. Not necessarily a high-end gaming monitor, especially if you are in love with G-Sync. But in terms of sort of, you know, desktop productivity, video creation,
Photoshop editing and stuff like that. I find these fantastically productive, and programmers that have seen my desktop have immediately like sat down and started arranging multiple columns, then looked at me and then ran off to find a credit card. So it's a fairly productive a desktop layout that I like. But I'll talk more about that next week after I kind of get used to it and get the desktop rearranged to fit it. But 38 inches gives you a lot of real estate. I mean, if I'm looking from one corner of the monitor all the way over to the other corner of the monitor, it definitely kind of envelops you. That CinemaScope gaming experience, which is pretty awesome.
Do you feel like the monitor is tall enough for the width of it? The you know, I see a lot of complaints on these ultra wides of the size of the display being like the width of display being very good, but the height of it just kind of seeming out of touch. Like as you try to work with Word documents or productivity or web pages, and you kind of have to relearn how to position things on a display in some ways.
You know, it doesn't bother me, but I've always known, especially this is a you know, something I've run into with a lot of programmers over the years when they were like, oh, this is a, you know, 1600 by 10, you know, 1000 monitor and not a 1600 by 1250 monitor. They'd be really angry about that last 250 or 400 pixels at the bottom of the monitor. And if that vertical real estate or lack thereof drives you insane, this might not be the best monitor for you. But you know, it does not bother me, and I kind of work in text all the time. You know, but again, I've never been one to, I've always preferred a standard resolution, and not really been upset like, oh, I wanted a 1250 monitor, not a 1080p monitor. It's like, let it go, dude.
Yeah.
You know, if that 200 pixels really pisses you off, you probably don't want, you probably don't want an ultra wide monitor. But on the flip side, the 38 has more vertical screen real estate in terms of pixels than the U34. Right. So that might make it more compelling, but also takes up a lot more.
3840 by 1600, right? Yeah.
But
I haven't seen one that size yet in person. At trade shows, whatever, but not like using. I think the biggest we have in here is the 34s. We don't even have any like. I think Acer has a 35 gaming display coming out soon, but I just haven't seen it come across yet.
No, it's basically, you know, it's the 34, except it's a couple inches wider, in either, you know, at both ends, you know, and 3840 by 1600, like, you know, 1600 is a pretty good, you know, vertical resolution. You know, I also just spent a month using a 4K monitor, so which could essentially fit 16 complete 1080p windows in the screen. So, you know, I'm not feeling cramped on this, but also because the pixel density was so high on the 4K monitor, you ended up running it, you scaled it to 300%, because if you tried to run it at 100%, your text was all down around 2 points. Which was something we were talking about on Tech Thing this week, was we had a viewer who was like, you know, I've got a couple apps. I only need them occasionally, so I reset my desktop to 1080p so I can read and click on the tiny boxes in these apps. And then I reset my monitor back to its standard 4K resolution. But, you know, if you have legacy apps that haven't been updated to work, you know, with scaling, it can be a really difficult thing to deal with, to the point where, you know, there are some registry hacks you can try, but you're kind of SOL, use a highly technical term. And Paul Sir.
Yep.
The incredible Windows maven. Thrott, thank you. I always think it's Thrott, and then I think it can't be because I think it's the right one. And then I second guess myself, and I look like an idiot. So thank you all for not shutting me down. Paul Thrott wrote a great article last year that it was basically talked about how he doesn't think Windows 10 will ever deal with high resolution or high DPI issues. And because that column he wrote was triggered by an article that Microsoft wrote about what it took to get Notepad to function properly at high res. Yeah. Microsoft may never fix the high DPI issues in Windows 10. And it's, you know, it's like, well, it works great for this and it works great for that. But as soon as you're like switching between a dock and a laptop, or if you're trying to run multiple monitors simultaneously, it all goes to to heck in a handbasket. And it turns out when you start reading the Microsoft article that screen resolution and handling it is incredibly difficult, to the point where I'm really happy I'm not trying to spend a lot of time moving in and out of docks, or when I do, I just, you know, mirror the monitors and deal with the irritation of that. But something worth considering. Yeah. High DPI scaling improvements for desktop applications and mixed mode DPI scaling in the Windows 10 anniversary update, which was one of the first big updates they did for that. That was back earlier this year. You know, there's certain situations that are incredibly intolerable, but DPI scaling is fascinating. And if you have older apps that are no longer being supported, it's a nightmare. You know, if you need that app on your desk 24/7, it was interesting. I got to check. Twitter shortly, because somebody responded that they had a better way. Because like for me, like the worst case scenario, if you don't want to resize your monitor temporarily, is like getting the magnifier out. Which, watching me using the magnifier on the Windows 10 desktop is like watching. well, there's a metaphor I'd make, but I don't think I can make it pink.
That's
and possibly
pretty good.
Well, you know what I mean. It's. You know, it's unfortunate to watch me try to deal with the magnets, the magnifying glass on the Windows desktop, but that could lead to a whole
Don't use the magnets. That's a very different topic, too. Yeah, the magnets are
very
different.
The magnifying glass, not the magnets.
Yeah.
So, in any case, I like the U3818DW so far. It is a big monitor. It is 38 inches diagonally, but the resolution looks good, and I'm slowly getting over my loss of the sort of retina resolution of that 4K monitor I had, which was very nice, very, very nice, especially for dealing with graphics. So, oh my goodness, we've pretty much run out of stuff to talk about.
Yeah,
we are waiting for the Radeon RX Vegas to ship so you can test them. Threadripper's coming. As far as you know, nothing's coming from NVIDIA. Nothing new.
Certainly hope
too
not.
Recently from Intel. Yeah, they may drop something just to see if they can make you squeal. Yeah, we're going to be talking about the Dell XPS 15. I think next week on Tech Thing, and we got the new Eero 2 in, which I don't think is going to deliver improved performance, but they've got a different form factor and they've tweaked some other stuff. The way, if you haven't updated the operating system on your iOS or Android phone, do it like yesterday. We talked about Shannon was down at DEF CON last week, and one of the other things, that thing the guy was wearing was 25 of the Hack 5 pineapples set into a logging system, so he could essentially log every band and frequency in Wi-Fi to figure out if people, amongst other things, like what was going on in the ether, as it were, or the Wi-Fi, as it were, at DEF CON, and figure out if anybody was trying to execute the Broadpwn. But Broadpwn takes advantage of some Broadwell chipset issues, or flaws would be a better description, and does not actually require you to have like Wi-Fi or your radio on. So, you know, essentially my understanding is even if, you know, the chip's off, you can still potentially be corrupted by this. So Broadpwn, it's been patched by both Google and Apple. You know, the Apple update came down a couple, 3 weeks ago. Android users, of course, are going to have to suffer through the process of their carrier getting the patch out. You know, it's pretty, you know, it's essentially a Wi-Fi based worm would be kind of a simple way of describing it. You know, it's a chip that's used by everybody or if not everybody, then a staggering number of cell phone manufacturers and cell phones. So, you know, it's like a flaw in the Broadcom. I'm going to quote, actually, how an obscure chip exposed a billion smartphones to hackers. That's up on Wired.com. The flaw existed in the part of the Broadcom code that handles automatic communications between the phone and an access point. So the entire process of taking over the Wi-Fi chip could occur without the user noticing anything amiss. And then it could repurpose the Wi-Fi chip and make it function as an access point and broadcast the attack to vulnerable phones within range. you know, Apple and Android have pushed out the fixes, and it's frustrating. It's a little frightening. You know, essentially a small bug in a Wi-Fi chipset can allow you to compromise Android and iOS. So something to think about. Updates. Update as fast as you can. Oh, fair. And voting good machines. Advice. They had a whole collection of voting machines that they purchased, decommissioned voting machines that they purchased specifically for hackers to attack at DEF CON this year. And Shannon talks about some of the results and what happened there. I'll give you a hint. Some of them are running XP. That's all I'm going to say here. You know, and when I think of XP, I think of security. Don't you, Ryan?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. For sure. That's what it stands for. Extra Pascurity.
Extra Pascurity. Give me the Pascetti with the sauce. And with that, ladies and gentlemen, I am going to stop baking here in the heat and thank each and every one of you for listening to this episode of This Week in Computer Hardware. twit.tv/TWICH is the place to get all our older episodes and the links to subscribe. You can find Ryan at PCPer.com. You can find me at TechThing.com and AVExcel.com. And we want to thank you. Wow, man, that producer is on it today. I shouldn't have been talking that fast. We want to thank each and every one of you for listening and hope to see you next week. With that, ladies and gentlemen, I'm Patrick Horton.
I'm Ryan Shrout.
We'll see you next week on Twitch.